Well, I want to continue my series on the Eightfold Path, which it probably took a few hundred years to consolidate the various things the Buddha said during his life into a system. So he may have had many aspects of the path he talked about, but over time they came up with the eight, and you know the Buddhist wheel, which is the symbol of Buddhism, has eight spokes. So they're usually, as I mentioned last time, preceded by the word right. Right. The eight of them are right view, right intention, right action, right speech, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right meditation. And I had this epiphany recently that if one replaced the word right with the word Buddhist, that would be a little less a snooty, maybe. Because, as I said last time, these translations that we're kind of stuck with came from 19th century scholars who mostly weren't Buddhists and didn't understand Buddhism except as a linguistic thing. So the word in Sanskrit, sama, can be translated as right or correct or perfect, but in the context of the modern world, where there are many religions and many, each of whom thinks that their way is right, I think it's best if Buddhism just say, well, this is our Buddhist path. So Buddhist, last time I talked about Buddhist view, which is really two main, Buddhism is really much more simple than it might seem, since there are 15,000 books in English on Buddhism. You could read them until you're practically dead and still not have read all of them in a lifetime. But the principles are really pretty simple. And what it means by right view, it means Buddhist intellectual understanding or conceptual understanding, is that the two most important teachings of the Buddha were that dukkha, again, usually translated as suffering, but I translate as loss. Dukkha is woven into the fabric of the universe. There's no escaping it. And the second principle, which is related to the first one, is that everything changes. Everything is in flux. There's no permanent, eternal entity, in particular ourselves. So because everything is in movement, things that exist now, particularly things that we care about, will not last forever, and they will fade away. And we eventually will fade away. Everything will fade away or change into something else. And so that understanding that, at least at the intellectual level, that these are fundamental truths about how things are, is Buddhist, the essence of the Buddhist view. The next one, Buddhist motivation or Buddhist intention, is, I think, really for Westerners practicing or studying Buddhism, I think is really very, very important, because it's not deeply examined. And most in this, it may be changing now with younger people, but right now most Buddhists in America are converts from some other religion of origin. And so what motivated us to shift teams, as I like to say. I was at seminary to be a Unitarian minister when I was young, and I shifted teams when I met Shunryu Suzuki, my teacher, to Buddhism. Of course, now, I was a little ahead of my time. Now, lots of Unitarian churches are have Buddhist elements. Sometimes the minister is a Buddhist. I know of many Unitarian ministers who are also Buddhists and teach Buddhism. So maybe I was a little ahead of my time, but I want to talk about the Tibetans like to talk about every teaching as three levels. And this is a very useful pedagogy, I think. Yeah, the inner, outer level, inner level, and what I call innermost level. So I'd like to talk about motivation that way, because there are many motivations. There isn't just one motivation to do anything. And as Jack Kornfield likes to say, motivation's never pure. There's always many reasons why we do anything. Some of them are selfish. So, and each of us, when we have discussion, we can talk about our own motivation. What brought us here, why we do this, what we think it's about. But traditionally, motivation is closely related to our own experience of dukkha, of loss. And maybe it's the motivation to come to that leads people to any spiritual practice, but loss, a vivid experience, a personal experience of loss, is often what brings people to the Buddhist path. It's no longer intellectual that loss is a truth, it's personal. And I think that at the outer level, when people come, a lot of the motivation is to help with our own personal loss, to assuage our grief or loss at some level. So maybe we have a personal motivation, or a lot of people, baby boomer generation people who came of age in the during the counterculture, I think, read about enlightenment in various books and wanted it. Maybe psychedelic drugs had some role to play, but that's all ancient history now. I don't know what the motivations are for younger people. They have somewhat different motivation than we did. Also the 60s, we're looking back and realizing the 60s and 70s were a time of great economic plenty in this country. We were rich. And most other countries were still recovering from the Second World War, and we ran the world. And it was it's hard to remember now that that was a real economic high point. Rents were cheap, wages were good, it was easy to get a job, there was full employment. You could, as many of us did, work for a while and then not work for a while. There was never a problem. So there was a lot of time left over to think about matters of personal fulfillment, enlightenment, liberation. So at the outer level of motivation, there's a sense of wanting something or needing something from Buddhism. And it would be too critical to say it's a selfish motivation, but it may be a personal, more of a personal motivation. You see Buddhism as something that's going to be helpful or useful for yourself. And that's a first step. The technical term in Buddhism for this step is bodhicitta, which literally means the thought of enlightenment, the thought of liberation. And that thought comes in a variety of sizes. It comes in a small, like olives, you know, it comes in a small, well actually olives, the smallest olive is called large. You know this? The olive industry figured out that small olives would never sell. So very small olives are called large. And then they have, you know, you can look it up on Wikipedia, there's all these sizes of olives. It starts with large, and then it goes extra large, super large, and then jumbo, super jumbo, colossal, super colossal. You know. Somebody back when they first started to can olives realized that they had to make it sound big, even if it was small. Although now I'm realizing, you know, we have so many olives now. The tastiest olives are these, I think, are these very small French olives that you can get at Whole Foods and other places. They're really quite tiny. And it, you have to invest in some real effort, because you don't get a lot of olive for each pit. You have to really, but you know, whereas if you get one of these colossal olives, particularly if they've been pitted, it's just instant gratification, this huge olive flavor. But anyway, small motivation is large. Even though it's small, it's large, because even a personal motivation is, everybody's, from the standpoint of dukkha, of loss, everybody's the same. Human beings are, of course, not identical, but in so many basic ways, in the experience of loss, we are all the same. Everyone, every human being experiences loss pretty much the same way we do. So to come to Buddhism out of an experience of loss, or even a sense of just curiosity that is tinged with loss, is, I think, how a lot of people come. So that's maybe the outer motivation. Inner motivation is really an extension. This is a, you know, extra large olive, or, you know, super olive, where you begin to, out of your own sense of personal loss, you realize, as I said, well, everybody has loss very much like mine. I can't just make this spiritual practice something that I'm doing for myself. I have to include other people who have loss as well. And so the deeper motivation that extends from our early experimentation with Buddhism is this might be good for everybody. Or at least what I'm doing in my practice should be something that helps other people than just myself. And this level of motivation happens to intersect very much with Judeo-Christian sense of social service and social justice. And so I think that's the kind of motivation that I think has helped Buddhism become a mainstream practice. And I think that metta practice, which you notice is not one of the Eightfold Path, you know, loving kindness is not on the Eightfold Path, which is why I said there's many, really many spokes to the path. And eight is a little bit arbitrary, but metta is extremely popular, loving kindness, because it is very familiar to us from our upbringing in our Jewish or Christian churches and in the culture at large. Anybody who listened to the inauguration speech today, did anybody hear it?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
It was full of that sense of duty and obligation to the community, to promote equality, to support justice, to work for the greater good. This is, in Buddhism, we call this the Bodhisattva vow, but it's really not Buddhist, it's universal. Just like loss is universal, a sense of caring for other people in an emotional way is also innate or universal. And so that inner motivation develops naturally out of personal motivation. And the order is different for each person. Some people start with a more other-directed motivation. Other people are very personal and private in their motivation. But there are deeper levels of motivation than this, actually. And that's what I wanted to spend the rest of the time talking about. There is I think, and we'll find out tonight if this is true, but I think for a lot of people that are attracted to meditation practice and this kind of spiritual practice have always been attracted to it, have a propensity for it, have a taste for it. And often that is discovered when you're children, when we're children. You have some experience in your childhood that awakens this feeling, or you, some children are just spiritual children, spiritually oriented children. And this is recognized. There's a great story in by Dogen about one of the early Zen ancestors in India. He says that the story goes that when he was born, a mirror was born with him. And wherever he went, the mirror went with him. Isn't this an odd image? And that when he was ordained as a Buddhist monk, the mirror disappeared. So what does it mean that a child has a mirror that follows him wherever he goes? I mean, there are some children that have a kind of precocity for a spiritual dimension of life, or a spiritual, they have maybe a radar for it, or a taste for it. It's rather mysterious, actually, how people come to practice and why. And this is, I think, in an earlier era, more magical thinking, particularly based in India, which had a well-developed doctrine in Hinduism of reincarnation and life after life. There is a sense that children like that in former lives were spiritual people, and so they have a kind of karma or karmic direction to be spiritual. I think that's what that idea of a mirror. A mirror is like a Buddha nature. So the mirror, they're mirror children. And there are lots of stories, both in the past and I think in our current life, where some snippet of teaching, or hearing, these days, hearing a teacher on the internet, or going to a lecture, or meeting some developed spiritual person, awakens something in you. This is not really motivation that's directly related to dukkha or directly related to personal loss. It's more related to a kind of inner dimension of spiritual life that some people have much more strongly than others, it would seem. And they're drawn to it, almost as like a memory. It feels familiar in some way, or it feels comfortable. And these experiences, initial experiences, can be very vivid. I remember the first time I went to a meditation group in Berkeley. This would have been 1967. I was in seminary, but I was interested in Buddhism. And it was in the living room of a teacher who's still living, Mel Weitzman. And I remember two things that were so vivid about the first time I went. One was when we bowed, we had these thin bamboo mats just like that over there where the shoes are. And they were rather new, and when you bowed, you could smell the smell of the bamboo. It was a very exotic smell. And the other was afterwards, Mel served genmai tea. Genmai is green tea with brown rice in it. It's a very unusual. I've never tasted anything like toasted brown rice. Yeah, in Japan, it's considered very cheap tea, but it has a very unusual flavor, and these were the days when these things were not known. And so those two things were to me like the smell and the taste of Zen practice, and it made me want to come back, almost as though those were familiar sensations for me. There was a certain period back in those early days when all the Buddhists in the Bay Area wanted to visit a psychic in Sacramento. She became very much in demand. And it was interesting because pretty much everybody who went was told that in a former life they were a high lama in Tibet. And I can say, well, that's a very good marketing, you know. Who wouldn't want to feel that? And I began to wonder, why wasn't anybody told they were a duck, you know, or a slave in Roman times? And we were all high lamas, and we felt so good about it, you know. But because there's this mysterious quality that we have, it's very hard to pin on anything. It's tempting to apply some kind of magical explanation for it. But I don't think it needs to be explained. I think it's just a part of how life is. You know, we grow up and we have propensities for things. Some people, I was identified very early as a child with musical gifts, and they were innate. I mean, when I was six, I guess I had heard the second movement of the Beethoven's Seventh Symphony, and I was picking it out on the piano, just without any training. And my mother was a music teacher, and she said, well, this is a child with talent. And this can happen, you know, in lots of different fields. Children who are precocious with art, you know, they suddenly start to draw, and you think, well, how do they learn to do that? And they draw beautiful things. And in the same way, I think that we have a spiritual yearning that can be awakened in various ways. I can't explain it, and I don't think it needs explanation. It just simply happens. The technical vocabulary of Buddhism, this spiritual yearning or spiritual inner feeling is called many names, called Buddha nature in Zen. Buddha nature. Each of us has the kind of seed or nature of Buddha or awakening. And Buddha nature seeks itself. Buddha nature is reflected, because it's how things are. Buddha nature is reflected in our experiences if we have eyes to see. And so the innermost level of motivation is Buddha nature itself is awakening to express itself in each of us, and finds some path to do that. So these are just some different ways to understand motivation, and there's a kind of big range between a more, you might say, almost selfish motivation. I just want something good for myself. A motivation like I was talking to somebody at Spirit Rock years ago, and she just said, well, I come here to be happy. I want to be happy. And that's a motivation, perfectly sound. Who wouldn't want to be happy? And I felt that for her to be able to say it so directly and so simply was already a fruit of her work there, because most people won't be, unless you're a little child. A little child might say, I want to be happy. That's what I want. But adults usually aren't quite so bald, you know, they hide that. But I want to be happy. I remember once I went in a private interview to my teacher, Suzuki Roshi, and I said, I want to be enlightened. Which is a little bit stronger than I want to be happy, but, you know, I was like 22. 23 years old. So for a late post-adolescent man struggling to avoid the draft and deal with various identity issues, to blurt out, "I want to be enlightened," is maybe age appropriate. Anyway, he said, didn't seem an unusual thing for a Zen person to say. He said, "Well, just keep practicing. Just, you know, stay with your practice. Don't worry about it too much." So, but it was very nice that he, now that I'm about the age that he was at that time, I'm thinking he probably thought, a little bit of a silly young man, it's okay, but if he sticks with it, maybe there's something there, something like that, you know. He can say whatever he wants, doesn't, but he has energy. He looks like maybe he might be a keeper, but let's see if he lasts, kind of thing. So many people came and went during that time. I did last, you know, here I am, after over 40 years. So something about that early kind of boyish motivation matured or deepened into something that, because "I want to be enlightened" won't carry you for too long by itself. There has to be, it has to dig down to this innermost motivation, which is not personal. You know, in the end, it doesn't matter what you want. You don't practice for that. You practice to express Buddha. And actually, sitting still, as I talked about earlier, is a way that we express Buddha. Buddha, the word Buddha just means to be awake, to be awake in clarity, see things as they actually are. And that's what, if enlightenment means anything, that's what it means, is to be able to see things clearly in a way that is transformative and helpful for yourself and other people. So, it's important to work on our motivation. You know, what brings us in the door is really not that important. You know, some people come to meditation because their girlfriend or boyfriend goes. And they say, "You want to come?" And they say, "Okay, fine." And it starts from there. You know, I know of many cases where the girlfriend or the boyfriend who tagged along is the one who really stayed with it. And the one who brought them is long gone, you know, so it's very hard to know. Sometimes you walk in the wrong door and you think you're going into a Chinese restaurant. You walk into a Chinese Buddhist temple. So motivation does, you know, how it starts is not as important as that you deepen it and you cultivate it and become aware of the various motivations that you have. And the Buddha's own motivation, Siddhartha, according to the story of his life, was that it was just so painful for him when he went out of his palace to see how people actually lived and how much suffering they endured. He was shocked and felt that he had to figure out why, how to help. And that was his motivation. That's what it says, but you know, he was a human being, and just like all of us, his motivation was probably mixed. He may have felt, "I don't want to be a king. I don't want to live here. I hate my father. You know, whatever my father wants, I'm not going to do that." You know, he was, who knows what his motivation actually was. Maybe he had a secret girlfriend in the village, and you know, that's why he went out into the town. They didn't write that down if it were so. It would be perfectly understandable and human if he did. But whatever his motivation, whatever our motivation, the most important thing is just to stay with it long enough to get a feeling for what it really is. To, you know, our tradition is Zen, and Zen means the practice of, core practice of Zen is silent sitting. And there are other forms of Buddhism where the practice is something else, chanting or recitation. And there are various forms of meditation Buddhism, three main ones in America right now, with various nationalities and so forth. So it's quite a potpourri of various styles. And each of us has to find our way through all of that. So now I'm interested, we have about 15 minutes for discussion. I'm interested in your own experiences and thoughts about this and what you may want to share about your own motivation or path. So whatever is on your mind, it's fine.
There's so many things that you mentioned that trigger memories for me, and I feel I grew up in the Unitarian Church, and one of the ministers in the very liberal Unitarian Church, because of course we learn about other religions, and when he talked about Zen Buddhism or Buddhism in general, I thought it was breathtaking because it was so different from anything. I couldn't even grasp the idea of it at the time, but I was always drawn to it. And then,
must have been a high lama in a former life.
It's so funny. And then to come back to it, to return to it via through the San Francisco Zen Center. And all throughout my life, I've just been drawn back and back.
Mm. Well, it's a little mysterious. It is. And I'm joking when I say, you were a high lama. That's a way of trying to explain the mystery. Mm-hmm. That fits. Mm-hmm. If that's true, then that makes sense, So it tries to wrap some sense around the mystery, but I rather like the mystery itself because it doesn't need an explanation, or the explanation actually lessens it a little bit. It's better to just, that's who you are. Mm-hmm. You have this sensitivity from very early on about it. My wife and I, Amy, were in a high school English class where we also studied all the world's religions at lightning speed, and I remember being very taken with Buddhism, just like you. It's mm-hmm. like, well, that's different. Yeah. What's that? And so... But, some of it is just we're put together in a way that attracts us to certain things. Mm-hmm. So that's just who you are. Mm-hmm. Does that feel comfortable to you?
Yes, it does. And it's very reassuring because I've had very little understanding of it. I've struggled with trying to understand what God means to me.
Mm-hmm.
Being Unitarian, it was nothing we were told to believe. So I felt like I floundered a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And this is beginning to feel right.
Mm-hmm.
It's beginning to feel like it fits, like somehow.
Well, it's true that Buddhism is put together rather differently than other religions. Mm-hmm. To the point that some people would say, well, it's not really a religion. I think it's a religion. The word religion means to rejoin. Ligio, the L-I-G part of religion is like ligament, it joins things. And the word yoga is the same kind of meaning. The word yoga is like a yoke. It joins things. It joins. So religion is anything that joins us to the divine, you might say. I like to use the word divine because it allows me to flow very easily in an interfaith context and nobody gets too upset.
Mm-hmm.
If I talk to a Christian about the divine, they're very comfortable, with that. And the only people who aren't comfortable with it are some Buddhists who will say, well, you can't say that. That's like God. And I'd say, well, of course I can say it. I just did, I'll say it if I want to say it. But, you know, in our tradition, as I say, we have the teaching of Buddha nature, which you can call it divine or not, but it's not personal. So, to me, divine means that part of reality which we're a part of, which we can directly experience, that isn't Karen, it isn't Lou, it isn't like individual, it's something bigger. So that's the word that I use for it. And I don't usually use the word God, because that is really the, begins to be the terminology of another religion. But the word divine can be the translation of many Buddhist terms that I can think of, so I'm comfortable with it.
Yeah. I grew up with sort of inner and outer religion. At home, my parents were theosophists. And so I learned about karma and reincarnation and absorbed and believed that always. But we always were sent to the nearest Protestant church in the neighborhood to go to Sunday school. So that was an outer religion. And I grew up not saying anything about the inside religion to other people.
Probably wise.
I know, even though I would see things, you know, at times, and I call it seeing with my eyes closed. But I, much later in life, I guess I started coming down to Green Gulch to take lessons with Wendy Johnson, got very involved in the garden, but I began to get interested in the Zen part of it too. And then I started in going weekly to this, you know, Christian churches. Well, I listen, but I'm not Bible-ish. I just don't swallow it.
The Bible?
Yeah. But I like the community here. I feel very much at home here. And on Mondays, the same day as, you know, a few hours ago, our prayer circle was meeting here. And we meditate and send healing energy, which I recognize as something I'd always known. I used to help my mother do energy healing when I was about 14. So, yeah, I went to a whole different, went to medical school eventually, but I still have this inner and outer kind of feeling about spiritual practice.
Well, that's right. There are the inner and outer dimensions. I have a feeling that a lot of what people who are now Buddhists felt was unsatisfactory about their religions of origin is that it seemed too outer, too much on the outside, too much of an outer shell of a religion rather than one that, in an inner sense, they sensed was what it is, and that is probably right. I mean, I think that in comparative religion, if you read people like Houston Smith, they have terms like exoteric religion and esoteric religion. And the religions of our childhood were, for the most part, exoteric religions, at least in those days. And the esoteric level wasn't brought forward, although your parents, sounds like your parents were more interested in the esoteric.
They started up here, you know, and then continued when we lived in Pasadena.
I see, good.
But my mother, back in those days, they would read to you. We didn't have television. So it wasn't just fairy tales. She would read Krishnamurti and some of the theosophical
That's right.
Authors.
Someone else? Anyone else?
I'm still thinking about that metaphor of being born with the mirror. And I have two different images. One is, so everything he saw was himself. And the other is, it's a perfect metaphor to express dualism. And so then when he was enlightened, the mirror disappeared.
I'm not sure he could look into the mirror. It's unclear how he was situated relative to the mirror.
That's what it sounded like to me, that it was like this.
No, I sort of pictured it the way it was described in the story. This is in the Shobogenzo. It's in the fascicle called Old Mirror, which I helped translate with Kaz. And there's incredible stories. There are mirror stories, the sixth ancestor story about the mirror, mirror standard.
Oh, look it up.
It's all these Zen stories about mirrors. They're all about mirrors. I picture the mirror as kind of behind him, kind of like a light or something, like a halo, like a companion. Well, the way Dogen describes it, it wasn't dualistic. It was more like, in the context of the whole fascicle, which is all about mirrors. In Buddhism, a mirror represents Buddha nature, or represents the Dharmakaya, or the ultimate, or the emptiness. And the enlightened mind is likened to a mirror that simply accurately reflects what's in front of it without any distortion.
That's right. I see.
And so the mirror, it basically meant he was spiritually precocious. And the adults in his world could see a kind of mirror-like quality. You know, you can look into the eyes of a child sometimes and they look like Buddha for like 5 seconds. You know, they have a certain look. And I remember a great story somebody in our other O'Hanlon Sangha said her daughter, when she was 5, ran into the kitchen one morning and said, "Hey, Mom, if God created everything, who created God?" And she's there with, you know, making stuff. And she's trying to think, what's she going to say to a question like that? And then the little girl, after about 5 seconds, just grabbed a cookie off the counter and ran out. So children's depth is very fleeting because they're children. But they definitely have... Oh, I have another wonderful story. This is a good friend. Some people were visiting them, and they had a 3-year-old that had come. And the family was had lost something. They weren't sure where it was, in the car or in their luggage, and they were looking around for it. And the little boy suddenly piped up and said, "Well, I don't know. I'm new." I'm new.
That's great.
Out of the mouths of babes.
Yeah, out of the mouths of babes. But you know, this kind of openness and mirror-like quality, we often lose as we grow older. You know, adults don't nurture it. They dismiss it or ignore it or belittle it. Children learn to hide it, and then they, once they're in school for a while, everything kind of locks down in their mind, and they're trained out of it, you know. But I can remember, and I've talked to many other people, that I used to just lie on my back and watch the clouds. That was a activity that I enjoyed a lot when I was a little boy. We had fruit trees in the front of my house, and in the summer the apricots would fall. And so I would lie just outside the perimeter of where the fruit was, and I'd watch the clouds, and with my hand I could just reach out without looking and pick up a ripe apricot and eat it. And there is a story in the Buddhist scriptures about the Buddha having young Siddhartha having an experience very similar when he was 6. He sat under a rose apple tree, which I looked up. It's a fruit tree native to India. And he fell into a kind of natural meditative state. And that he forgot about it until he was sitting under the bow tree meditating on his road to enlightenment, and he remembered that state of mind. That natural meditation became his practice. He recalled something from childhood. So I'm not just speaking out of school. These things are recorded in the spiritual literature. You know, and in the Bible, it does have some interesting things about Jesus. He was when he was young, 10 years old, he stood up in the synagogue and preached to the rabbis, I believe. Also precocious.
Is that in the New Testament,
yeah,
or is it Gnostic?
New Testament. I think it's in the New Testament. Yeah. Well, we're just about out of time. I wanted to make a couple of announcements. We are having a Saturday sitting on the first Saturday, which is the second, I believe, here from 9 to 2, or you can come to part of it if you like. I will be sending out the details in an email, so any of you that want to be on our email list, be sure to write your email on a card in the wicker box, which is also our donation box, and I'll make sure you're on the list. Just for those of you who've never been to one of our Saturday sittings, they're quite informal. We sit one period and I give a talk, and then we do a brief service, and then we have tea, and we come back for a couple more sittings, and then we have lunch. And after lunch, from 1 to 2, I teach some practice or some meditation from my book on aging. Aging is a spiritual practice. Last time we did a practice called Vertical Time. We may go back to doing another session in Tonglen, which is a compassion practice, compassion visualization practice. Anyway, for those of you who are familiar with my book, I've got a practice like that after every chapter. So given the average age of our little sangha here, I thought it's a good time once a month to visit the topic of aging in our spiritual life. So that's what we do, and if you don't want to come for the whole time, just come for the first sitting in the lecture, that's fine too. So if you're on the mailing list, we'll send you the details. Also, the Monday night program for the homeless men, you could hear them just after dinner a little bit, is going quite well. Lois, who's the head of the volunteers, has worked out now with other churches to do the cooking, and they send the food over. So they're only actually cooking for the men one Monday a month, the first Monday of the month, which happens to be a Monday that we don't sit. So they have enough volunteers for February, but I think Lois is still looking for volunteers for March and April. This would be the first Monday of March.
March is filled.
It's filled now?
Yeah.
Oh, maybe they don't need us. Maybe April.
Yeah.
So maybe any people could talk to Amy if you're interested in joining with that.
Yeah, Lou and Peter and Mary and I did it in December. It was
very nice.
It was great.
The men are very nice.
It was a good team working together.
And
I did it in December too.
Yeah.
And one of the staff from the REST program, young member Gary, came and sat with us. He goes on at midnight, so he's kind of just marking time in the early evening, so he came over and sat with us, and he may come again. Maybe his schedule changed this week. That program's going to go through April 15th, and then it will stop for the rest of the year until the cold weather. So it was good that we could participate. You got to know some of the men. An interesting group. Any other announcements?
We covered them all.
Okay, well, we conclude by reciting the Three Refuges in Pali on your card if you don't know it. Buddham Saranam Gacchami.